This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There's a new Town of Normal city manager, a promotion from within, and the first woman to head municipal administration in Bloomington Normal.
I've been blessed to be a part of this organization, and I am honored to be offered the opportunity to serve as city manager.
Deputy City Manager Pam Reese steps up when Mark Peterson retires at the end of March. Bloomington Normal has no residential hospice program. Patients have to be wealthy enough to afford 24/7 in-home care or go to a hospital or nursing home to die. That could change, as Judy Valente reports. And John Norton examines the legacy of Illinois Wesleyan University women's soccer coach Dave Barrett. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 23rd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington aldermen are continuing to discuss options to eliminate a projected budget deficit, and they started with the biggest ticket item, the city's solid waste services. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner joins us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings, and he's in the studio with GLT's Charlie Schlenker.
Thanks, Mike. The city is facing a $3 million deficit, fixing the $1.1 million gap between what it costs to provide solid waste services and what the program collects in revenue could go a long way to balance the budget. The council heard three options last night to address the gap in funding the city's solid waste service. What are aldermen considering?
Well, there are quite a variety of things. Actually, I think there are a lot more than three pieces. Some of the pieces are fairly small. One of the things that Alderman said that kind of surprised me was that they do want the staff to come back at the next meeting, February 12th, and talk about privatizing the service, which essentially, from my vantage point, I've been involved in since I was at the International City Management Association in academic studies and others about privatizing. And about half the cities that privatize are glad they did it. About half are not glad they did it. And there are all kinds of hazards and problems of doing that.
What makes the difference between success and disquiet?
Size of city and the extent to which you can take advantage of the market forces.
So the bigger the city, the easier it is to find competitors?
No. Actually, it tends to be smaller to medium-sized. You know, Bloomington and smaller size cities. But certainly the smaller the city, the easier it is. You got a city of 5,000 or 10,000 or 20,000 people, it's a lot easier for someone to come in and take your, pick up your trash. It's also easier if you don't have to worry about brush. If you're in an area in the southern tier where you don't have to worry about seasons, if you take solid waste off the plate, which are things that we have had. Now, one of the aldermen, I believe it was Alderwoman Howman, said that we have a Lexus service. Well, we'd be trading a Lexus service for a beat-up Hugo. And so I think that that's what is a problem. The other thing is that we've certainly had experience. I've had it over 30 years experience where contractors will come in and they will promise you something and they will undercut you. And then within 2 years or so, they will raise the prices after you've fired your workforce, after you've got rid of all your vehicles, after you then would have additional startup costs. So I'm hugely skeptical of privatization. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't be willing to look at the evidence.
But there are also fee increases as a possibility, or sure, reduction in service,
right,
combined with fee increases. So what about that dynamic? What do you think of those?
I think what we ought to do is just do what Normal does. Charge people for what it costs. Take an enterprise fund and just balance the budget. This is what I've said for 5 years. I don't understand why this is such a complicated issue. It does not have to be a complicated issue. Now, there are partly, I think it's because of our ward system. That different people have different issues depending on what side of the city they represent. In Normal, everybody represents the same constituency. And so I think that's one of the reasons why. People on the east side have different issues and views. They're particularly concerned about, leaves and brush. People on the west side and central Bloomington are very concerned about bulk waste and whether there'll be illegal dumping and things of that nature. The other thing that I didn't finish my answer to your first question is one of the factors that helps increase or decrease the cost of privatization if you have lots of competitive options. So if we were in the suburbs of St. Louis, or especially if we were in the suburbs of Chicago, that we would have many, many more competitors who could come in and provide our service if we didn't like what we were doing. The other thing you do
is you're arguing that we're kind of in the middle. We're neither too small nor too big to have multiple contractors serve a large metro area and provide some price control.
The other thing you lose is control. Right now, if somebody calls me and says, hey, you forgot to pick up our trash, or you did not plow our street, you know, whatever, on some cul-de-sac, I can call Jim Karsha, Director of Public Works, and we can get somebody out there by the end of the day and make sure that that's taken care of. If you've got somebody out of Springfield or Chicago who is a distant company, what are you going to say? Well, we'll remember this in 2 years when your contract is up.
Well,
so you lose control.
Yes, but proponents could argue that a quality drafted contract can address some of those and provide clawbacks or penalties or incentives for great service.
They can. I'd love to see the ideal one. If there was, I think we would have all heard about it and say, hey, this is the boilerplate. This is the fix-all, no matter who you are. Certainly when I go to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, almost nobody is really that excited about, for example, privatization. It's certainly not a panacea. It's not going to fix it. And it's going to cost our citizens more money. There's no question about it. They're going to have to pay the cost. We're subsidizing it now. If we just say, we're going to wash our hands of this and we're going to let some private company come in and do it, they're going to provide the service. They may start out at what they're currently charging, and eventually they're going to ratchet up the prices. I mean, we've seen it time and time again.
How much would fees have to increase maybe over time to make Solid Waste Enterprise Fund neutral?
On average, about 27, 28, about what you see in normal. You know, about $27, $28. Right now, it's $25 if you have the big cart. It is $21 if you have the medium-sized cart. And it is $16 if you have the small cart. And so if we would not have to have all carts the same. We would just have to average about $27, maybe $29, $27, $25, something like that. If we had, because we have this goofy, frankly, I think that was a terrible decision to go to a three-cart size. Almost nobody has that. It just makes everything much more complicated, and it costs us the same pretty much to pick up a small cart as it does a large cart. So at the end of the day, this is – we've been fighting about trash since 2 years before I was even mayor, and they're still fighting about trash.
If you decide, or the council decides, to reduce services, the frequency of a bulky waste pickup, for instance, what's the effect of that on the municipality and the character of the town?
Well, that would depend on who you talk to, and nobody has a crystal ball. There certainly is a possibility of more illegal dumping. We could have exceptions for landlords, and we could charge landlords money. That is, right now, we have situations where people, at the end of their lease in certain areas of town, just dump the whole place on the sidewalk, and the city of Bloomington picks it up. And that's part of the deficit that we have. And so I think that there are more surgical ways to do this. I would very, very likely, unless there was some great contract that I've never seen before, I would very likely have to veto any bill or any ordinance that moved toward privatization.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Terry Renner of the City of Bloomington about options to close the budget deficit. Do communities that go the route of privatization actually see savings even after the ratchet up that you're forecasting?
Again, going back to the 80s, the data on this has not changed a whole lot. Some do, some don't. There are a lot of variables that go into play. E.S. Savas is a very famous political scientist from the 1980s. He was a big Reagan supporter of privatizing everything that you possibly could privatize. And ultimately, the research does tend to show us that if you're going to save money in privatization as a local government, the one area you're most likely to save money is solid waste. But even that's at best a 50-50 proposition. even if you save money, you lose control.
It's personnel costs, though, plus pension costs, right?
Yeah, that's factoring all of those things in. Correct.
So how much of the solid waste budget is salaries?
I don't happen to know that offhand, Charlie, but if we were to charge people roughly $27, $28, that would cover absolutely everything, including pensions, all personnel costs, all our costs associated with it right now.
Are you seeing aldermen trending in one way or the other, a mix of options or one preferred option?
I think we're seeing aldermen trending toward privatization.
Why do you...
And just, you know, as I said, you know, depending on what the contract looked like, I would very likely have to veto a contract. The council can pass it over my veto. They just need a 2-to-1 majority, which they may very well have. But if I think it's a bad choice and a bad decision, even if I know I'm going to lose, I am not going to sign a bad contract.
What constitutes a core service? Alderman Hellman suggested that trash pickup is unlike fire and police, and is not, in her book, a core service.
Right.
What is a core service in your book and according to a more common definition?
As somebody who's also a political scientist who's studied urban politics and written about it extensively, I would have to go back to some of what the core cities did, the first cities that formed about 800 years ago during the Renaissance, and that was public safety, police, fire, the equivalent, they didn't have 911 service, but the equivalent of things like that, and trash. So I do think trash is a core service, but there's a difference between providing for it and actually producing it. And that's the distinction that an E.S. Savas would note, said that the city can provide for it with a contract, but they don't have to deliver the service. A private company can do it better. I am unconvinced that the evidence is that clear.
It's
possible.
Is there anything else that's going to net $1.1 million, though?
No. Nothing that was put on the table or that we have on the plate right now. We can get to the $1.1 million in other ways without privatizing the service. And let's be clear, we're going to save $1.1 million, but our taxpayers are not going to save $1.1 million. They're going to have to pay that to a private company. They're going to have to pay more money. They're going to have to pay the cost of their service and somebody's profit in order to deliver that public service. So those are the reasons why I don't support it. I support some version of what City Manager Steve Rasmussen has proposed, so that we can close this finance gap, pick up bulk waste less often, and brush, charge for bulk waste at certain times of the year, figure out a way to balance our budget with what we have, or raise the cart fees.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Terry Renner. The town readdressed its funding of the Small Business Development Center at Illinois Wesleyan University in late November. Aldermen voted in a split vote to fund the SBDC at a 50-50 split with the town of Normal, even though the town indicated they were expecting to only pay for 40%. Why was this back on the agenda last night?
Well, there apparently was a technicality with the intergovernmental agreement, and we had to remove the town of Normal from the intergovernmental agreement in order to repass this. There have been times where the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal do pay 50-50 on some kinds of things. There are times where we pay 60-40, and that 60-40 split is based on population and size of community. So this is something, I think the dollar amount on this was so small, I supported the 60-40 split. I obviously was not in the majority.
Well, it went back to 60-40 this time, right? With the revision?
No. The city of Bloomington is going to pay 50%. The town of Normal is going to pay 40. And there is going to be a deficit that the business center at Illinois Wesleyan will have to eat or figure out a way to
make. So the dollar amount did not actually change last night, just the mention of the town of Normal in the intergovernmental agreement.
It was kind of a housekeeping chore, if you will.
So what are some 50-50 splits? And do you think that a 60-40 could be the way forward?
Well, for example, many of the contributions we've made to the airport in the past, in attracting new airline business has been the same. The contributions to the EDC. Now, the future contributions to be an advantage are not exactly 60-40, but the city of Bloomington is being asked to bear a somewhat larger share of the burden than the town of Normal. And so I guess that does beg the question is, you know, what types of things are more appropriate to go 50-50 on? What types of things are more appropriate to split 60-40? I would say certainly anything that refers to economic benefits to the community would, generally speaking, should be 60-40.
Okay. Speaking of economic benefits, the Memorandum of Understanding with the EDC is now through the City Council as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some members of the County Board and some members of the Normal Town Council have been very dissatisfied in recent months and years about the level of communication going on between the EDC and the municipalities and governmental bodies. Is that shared by the City of Bloomington?
Yes.
What do you think you ought to be getting that you haven't been getting?
Excellent question. A variety of information. But, I mean, communication can take many forms. Sometimes it's just sitting down and giving us a list of projects, the things that you're doing. I can't speak for the entire City Council, but I think the entire City Council, I don't think there is a person who would disagree that we need more information for what it is that EDC is doing and what kind of bang are we getting for our buck.
Is this a function of a lack of reporting from the city's representative on the EDC board? Could that be the way to go forward?
That's not the reason. We're the representative from the EDC, Alderman Burgess, does not have that information either. The city manager doesn't have, our current and previous city managers don't have the information that we would like.
Is the Memorandum of Understanding going to cure it?
We shall see.
Would the EDC get a chop of assistance from the city if it's not cured? Is it that bad? Is the relationship that bad?
I don't know that the relationship is that. I wouldn't describe it as being bad. I think it's just these are holes that need to be plugged in order for us to be confident that we're getting our money's worth. And so I think that will happen as we move forward. It could be that we see a cut to the bottom line, to answer your question. I just don't know that the relationship I would describe as quite that bad.
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Charlie.
I'm Mike McCurdy, the mayors of Bloomington and Normal. Join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas. Mayor Koos, one of the decision makers in the Town of Normal, naming its new city manager today. Pamela Reese is currently Normal's deputy city manager. She was introduced today during a news conference at Normal City Hall. GLT's Ryan Denham was there. Ryan Reese is a longtime Town of Normal employee. Tell us about Pamela Reese.
So Pamela started working in municipal government about 27 years ago, right out of grad school. She earned her Master of Public Administration from Western Michigan University. That year, 1991, she's hired in Normal, eventually becomes the assistant to the city manager in 1994, rising up to deputy city manager in 2010. In that role, she now oversees a bunch of different town functions, director of HR, oversees fire department, finance, IT, public works, among many others. Here's what Mayor Chris Koos had to say about Reese's pedigree today.
We are also so very fortunate to have someone so highly qualified to manage our municipality now and in the very bright future that we seek.
So today during the news conference, Reese talked about taking that first job in Normal. She thought she'd stay a few years and move on, maybe back to Michigan. She said one of the reasons she stayed was the mentorship she got from her boss. That's current city manager Mark Peterson, who's retiring, and his predecessor, Dave Anderson. Here's Pam Reese talking about why she connected ultimately to Normal.
This is an organization with vision and values, one that recognizes and promotes an environment of service excellence, stressing productivity, integrity, responsibility, dedication, and empathy. Each of these core beliefs are what defines this organization. It is what makes this municipality, the Town of Normal, unique.
And much of the town council was there today at the news conference. I was told that the vote to hire Pam Reese was unanimous. Here's Councilmember Kathleen Lorenz on why they selected her.
Her background of our community, her institutional knowledge, her understanding of our culture was really the X factor that we wanted to make sure we protected that. And quite honestly, she interviewed extremely well. And for being a person that I think, you know, has played maybe a less forward role, one more behind the scenes, I was very impressed with her vision for moving forward. So I'm very excited.
So Ryan, when will Pam Reese take over from Mark Peterson?
So that happens on April 2nd. That's a couple of days after Mark Peterson's final day on the job on March 30th. So they'll overlap for a little while, and I know that that handoff time was important to town officials. I asked about her salary and her contract. Town spokesperson Dan Irvin says that's to be determined likely by a vote of the council in early February.
So that seems unusual, is it? A municipal employee coming in without a salary or a contract? She must have some idea of what's in store for her in terms of salary and what that contract might look like.
You know, I can't say for sure. One possible explanation is that Pam Reese also, you know, part of her current job duties is running the HR side of town government. So perhaps that was some wrinkle that led to that. But I really can't say for sure.
So municipalities across the country are facing all kinds of challenges, revenue, tax increases that they have to institute to meet some shortfalls. What are some big challenges she'll face here in the town of Normal, in her first few years on the job?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, right away, it's going to be budget, right? So just this week, the council was meeting for half a day talking about next year's budget, looking to close a pretty sizable budget deficit. There's going to be 25 positions eliminated on top of other cuts. Another challenge in a couple of years is the political makeup of the council could change, right? If Mayor Coos doesn't run again, or if more conservative members make their way onto the council, that could make the city manager's job of balancing all those competing politics, very different, very challenging for Mark Peterson's job. But short term, it is the budget. And here's what Pam Reese had to say about how that might shape that first year on the job.
Yes, there are challenges on the horizon. I think that with the team we have and the policymakers that we have, we will work together to achieve results. I think there's much we can do, and we have a great plan. And kind of quoting former Mayor Kent Carriker, we plan our work and we work our plan. And with that strategy, we'll continue to move forward.
So Mark Peterson is a fairly well-known commodity in this community, city manager for 30 years, sort of one of the public faces of the town of Normal. We don't know as much about Pam. How do you think she and Mark Peterson might be different?
Well, that's the big question, right? I think something to keep in mind is that she's not coming from the outside. So this is not like a situation where Pam Reese has big shoes to fill. She kind of already wears the shoes some of the time anyway, because she's running a portion of the town at any given time. She is the third person to ever hold this job. Mark Peterson was preceded by Dave Anderson, and Dave Anderson was the first city manager. So here's Mayor Chris Coos talking about that history.
Town will only have had two city managers in 50 years, and that's a very, very unusual scenario in today's world or in the world of 25 years ago. That really says something, and what it says is that the town of Normal is a special place.
Also notable is that this is the second straight internal candidate for the town of Normal's city manager job. Mark Peterson was working under Dave Anderson for a decade before he got the top job. And here's what Mark Peterson had to say about his deputy getting the big job.
Pam has understands the culture of the organization, the values, yet she'll have a different style. She's got different priorities, which is exactly what you want. You don't want another Mark Peterson. You want somebody with new ideas, new energy, and she'll bring that to the table. But she also, again, I think will there'll be that continuity in terms of organizational values and culture.
She's also the first woman to hold the job in the town of Normal. We're still checking on this, but it sounds like she'd be the first woman to hold that city manager job in either Bloomington or Normal. And I asked her about that today, and she said that distinction did have some special meaning to her.
I just think it's very exciting for the profession. Since I started in 1991, the number of women in leadership roles has grown significantly, and I'm just proud to be part of that group.
So we know a little bit about the search process. We know the town hired an outside recruitment firm. What do we know about how they selected Pam Reese for this job?
So Mark Peterson announced he'd be retiring in March. That was way back in August. That gave the town 7 months to find his successor. As you mentioned, the town hired a recruitment firm, GovHR, to help find Peterson's successor. It cost about $20,000. Our council, one council member who did oppose that hiring was R.C. McBride, who also happens to be our general manager here at GLT. I'm told there were 49 applicants for the job. And here's council member Kathleen Lorenz again on how they whittled that down to about a half dozen finalists, but only one interview.
We looked at a first cut of six, and we chose to begin interviewing with her, and we were unanimous with our choice at that point. And so in being judicious with the dollars spent on the interview or the search process, we stopped when we knew we had the right candidate.
So it raises kind of an obvious question, right? Why did you use a recruitment firm if someone so qualified for the job was, like, literally working down the hall? I asked Councilmember Kevin McCarthy about that, and here's what he said.
Until you go through a process, you don't know the outcome. And so although we had strong confidence in Pam, we felt we owed it to the citizens of the town of Normal and, frankly, all the staff and employees of the town to make sure that we had the right person leading the city into the future. I mean, I can't imagine a more pivotal decision for the city council on into the future. I mean, we tend to hang on to our city managers, and we want to find somebody that's committed. And so we went through the process, and I think we're unanimously opinion that we have it. And so we think that the citizens of the town can rest assured that we do it, that our due diligence on their behalf, and the staff can be really proud and confident that they already have the right leader.
Current city manager Mark Peterson is cycling out. Pam is taking over. What's the process? What's the timing? What's all that look like, Ryan?
So Pam Reese would take over on April 2nd. Then the town would presumably look for an assistant or a deputy to come in underneath her. At the same time, the city of Bloomington is going to be searching for a city manager for itself. The last one they hired was an external candidate, if you remember, David Hales. He's since left for a new job in Joliet. Interim Bloomington city manager Steve Rasmussen is running the show for the time being, and he said he wants to be considered for that job on a full-time basis.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
GLT's Ryan Denham recapping today's announcement that Pamela Reese has been named the new city manager for the town of Normal. Her first day on the job is April 2nd. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Donald Trump's administration has been in power for a year now. State of Trump is a series discussing what's changed in the state and what might be ahead. IPR education reporter Dusty Rhodes talked with a high school government teacher in Springfield, Neil Calderon, about how the Trump presidency has affected the way he teaches.
I teach government, U.S. history, and world history at Southeast High School.
Has it changed at all in the past year?
In terms of the basics that we teach, no, but in terms of the way I approach how to incorporate current events, it does. I think the most challenging aspect has been some of the topic matter has not been what I would say traditionally acceptable in a classroom, and so finding a way to still discuss issues that come up but not veer off into the profane has been interesting. It's been a challenge. It's not something that I've had to do in the years past, but it's been one where I think because the president likes to use Twitter and social media, I think that my students have a little bit more awareness of what's going on, just because that's the world in which they tend to communicate and get their current events information from. And so I think they've brought more questions to me over the last year than in years past.
So did you have to say poopy hole in class?
I try not to replace language, but I instead address it without directly saying the comments, saying controversial comments or using profanity to describe other countries, things like that. I mean, I think the thing that's changed overall in the 16 years that I've been teaching is that I've told my students this, is that in the past I would have said, make sure to consume as much news and information as possible and watch things like CNN. And now I find that I'm almost warning them not to consume too much 24-hour news, to pick their news sources much more carefully. And when they do, to use their own filter and decide what's good information, what's not. I always start off my government classes with the idea that they are the most powerful people in the history of humankind, and that they can access information about anything that humans have known in a matter of moments. They've got devices that send signals to space and back, and they can use that to access anything. And so they've got more information than anybody's ever had before. The problem is that it's all unfiltered, and a lot of it comes without any context.
So how do you teach them to figure out what's a good source?
Just kind of going through the process of taking, if it's a current event story, saying, okay, here's how one outlet is covering it, here's how another outlet's covering it. What do you guys see as the similarities and differences, and why do you think that is? And then going through that kind of process.
So are you seeing a higher level of engagement? Are you seeing more enthusiasm on, you know, either way?
I think we've seen a lot of awareness. And if awareness translates to action, I think that'll be encouraging both ways, because it seems like I don't have a student that doesn't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I will say I always get going with registering my students to vote in there, and I have easily 90%+ of them registered now. I think I only have like 5 students that in my 3 government classes that have yet to register.
You are a Democratic precinct chair, is that what you are?
Precinct committeeman.
Mm-hmm. Precinct committeeman. So you obviously have strong personal views. And as a teacher, you're supposed to be like a journalist, pretty neutral,
yeah.
Right?
One of the things, and I kind of take pride in this, over the 16 years that I teach, most of my students are still guessing at what political associations I have by the end of the semester, by the end of a period that we have a class. So I try to keep it as neutral as possible, present both sides. It has been more challenging, and especially in this last year, because there are things that, when you look at the things that President Trump does, it is outside the norm, and it's a balancing act between you don't want to normalize something. I mean, where if a president talks about a rally that's predominantly white supremacists and saying there's some good people there, I don't want to normalize that. But at the same time, I'm cognizant of the fact that I do have strong opinions on this. And I try not to make my opinions the ones that the students form. I want them to form their own opinions.
IPR's Dusty Rhodes talking with high school government teacher Neil Calderon. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Mike McCurdy. There is a new effort to fill a gap in service for the dying in Bloomington Normal. For decades, Dr. Benjamin Moore was a well-known figure to many in Bloomington Normal. Moore had been the resident psychologist for the Baby Fold and the clinical director of the Hammett School for Children with Special Needs. Moore passed away last October at the age of 77 from lung cancer. He was able to remain in his own home until death, because his 2 sons were available to help him and could afford home health care. Bloomington Normal doesn't have non-home residential hospice. The closest 24-hour residential hospice is in Peoria. Moore's sons, Kevin and Todd, have now established the Benjamin and Mary Evelyn Moore Foundation in honor of their father and mother, and the foundation seeks to raise funds for a residential hospice in Bloomington Normal. Kevin Moore tells GLT's Judy Valente the idea for the foundation arose out of his own family's struggle to give his father quality end-of-life care.
He was living alone, and he, you know, was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and it was, you know, really clear that it was terminal. You know, someone who was alone, and, you know, I lived out of state, my brother lives out of state, and, you know, like, what do we do? And I initially asked Dad, I brought him out here to the East Coast. I live in the Philadelphia area, and had him live with me and my family so that we could take care of him. But just the simple fact that our house has stairs made it not comfortable, made it not really workable physically for him, in addition to him being away from, you know, the community that he loved. And so he made the choice after about 5 weeks to move back and permanently to Bloomington, and that he wanted to die in his home.
At one point, did he need hospice care, and what was there for him?
Right. So he needed hospice care, and there are services in Bloomington Normal, some very good services that you can hire, you know, privately to come in home, some home health aid. Hospice itself, as covered through Medicare, is a very limited service of a couple times a week that is sort of designed to kind of guide the family, but not actually do the work. And so that's sort of the day-to-day work of helping, physically assisting the dying person.
Your father had you and your brother and maybe other relatives, but what would there have been for someone who didn't have that?
Exactly, nothing. I mean, if you have enough, if you happen to have, you know, a lot of cash on hand, you can, you know, pay a service to come in and help you. And if your house is physically laid out in a way that you can do that, then that's an option. But if you don't have either of those two things, then, you know, in Bloomington Normal, there isn't another option. There isn't a local in-town residential hospice. The closest residential hospice is in Peoria. So if you either don't have, a significant amount of money at the end of your life, or you happen to live in a house that has, you know, stairs or is physically just not capable, it's hard to know what to do. You can either move out of Bloomington Normal, or you can get substandard. You can have not a good a death as would be possible otherwise. It's a very limiting option.
It seems, though, then, that this situation that you found your father in got you thinking about, well, what do other people do?
Exactly right. You know, just in terms of the service, the actual hospice, residential hospice service, it seemed to me, to my brother and I, that we wanted to give other people the opportunity that our father had, that we wanted to help them have a good death also. So we created, with my dad's blessing, the Benjamin and Mary Evelyn Moore Foundation, when the goal of the of this nonprofit is to create a residential hospice in Bloomington Normal.
And how far along are you in that process?
We created the organization as a nonprofit last year. We've been collecting donations. The people have been very generous to the foundation, and we're moving towards trying to pin down the right physical space, a place that is one level, that doesn't have stairs, that's big enough, that the hallways are wide enough, and that is quiet and beautiful.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Moore, the son of Benjamin Moore, who was the psychologist for Babyfold and the Hammett School. The Moore family has established a foundation with the view of establishing a residential hospice in Bloomington Normal. If people would like to help you in this effort, how can they help the foundation?
Certainly, we welcome donations.
Is there a website?
We don't have a website yet, but if they want to correspond with me directly, my email is Kevin Carson Moore, KevinCarsonMoore, @yahoo.com. They can also mail anything to our address, 29 Sunset Road, Bloomington. But how can people help is a great question. I think that really the thing that I would love to see is to have a conversation as a community, that for Bloomington Normal to think in a civic-minded way, to think about how what can we do for other people, right? How can we create things that will help other people sort of in need? I was born and raised in Bloomington, and I had no idea what services were available or not when, Dad was in the circumstance that he needed end-of-life services. And so what I would ask of other people is just to sort of think about what would be helpful to others in our community. And that's really sort of the fundamental, I think, question, the civic-minded, altruistic question that I would pose to you, and I'd pose to anyone listening.
It seems to me what you're saying too is that those of us who have aging parents should be thinking of these end-of-life issues, end-of-life care issues, and those of us who are aging ourselves should be thinking about
yes.
what we're going to do about ourselves.
Well, that's true. I think it's helpful. Something that my mother taught me was to think ahead and to plan these things, right? Not just to have, to have a will, but to have, if someone chooses, a do not resuscitate order, to have and to think about what's in place, not just for themselves, but also for other people, right? Even if it's not that you specifically will ever need a residential hospice, but that other people will, and that you've got to travel to at least Peoria in order to have that be sort of a possibility, that there wouldn't be anyone in Normal who couldn't sort of benefit from this. And so, and you know, healthcare these days, I have great respect for the two large hospital systems in Bloomington Normal, but healthcare systems these days are not, their job is not to create what is needed in the community. Their job is to try to improve the services that they provide. So if there's a service that they don't provide, that's someone else's job. It's not clear whose. And that's what I mean about the civic-mindedness in terms of just thinking about our fellow citizen and what their needs are that might not be available in 2018 here in this current environment.
Kevin Moore is the son of Dr. Benjamin Moore, who was very active at the Baby Fold and the Hammett School as a psychologist. He passed away in October 2017, and his family has established a foundation to look into the possibility of creating the first residential hospice in Bloomington Normal. Dr. Moore, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
I'm Judy Valente.
Kevin Moore says the foundation has received several hundred thousand dollars in pledges. He says he's currently looking for community partners to support the effort to establish a full-service residential hospice. It's Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois Wesleyan women's soccer coach Dave Barrett is leaving a big legacy as he leaves the Twin Cities. Barrett has accepted the head coaching position at Division I Fairfield University in Connecticut after 17 years at IWU. He brought the Titan women's soccer program to new heights with NCAA tournament bids in eight of the last 9 years and a 234-85-35 record. GLT's John Norton caught up with the Massachusetts native while he was in Philadelphia last week. Barrett says the opportunity to coach a Division I team and return to his native New England was an opportunity too good to pass.
Absolutely. It really checked all the boxes in regard to the personal and the professional. My wife and I are both native New Englanders. I grew up in Massachusetts and went to college in Connecticut. My wife is from Connecticut and went to college in Connecticut. We both have family and friends still in the area. So that was a big factor in consideration. And professionally, you know, it's a jump up that not a lot of Division III coaches are fortunate enough to have an opportunity to do and move from Division III level to Division I. So, you know, it really was a perfect storm for us to have this opportunity come down our way.
Why now?
You know, I wasn't looking for anything. It just sort of came about. The athletic director is someone who I've been friends with for a long time when we were both colleagues at Yale 20 years ago, and he ascended to the athletic director position at Fairfield. He called me about the position, and, you know, kind of one thing led to another. So it was just not necessarily something I was looking to do. We love Illinois Wesleyan. We love the community. And it just sort of fell into our laps a little bit, and everything really sort of worked out about as perfectly as it could have to make this happen.
Well, you played Division I soccer at Yale, correct?
No, I coached at Yale. I played Division III soccer at Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Oh, okay, all right.
But I coached at Yale for four seasons.
So what's the how big a step up is it on the coaching end to move from Division III to Division I on the women's soccer side?
I think it's a big deal. Like I said, not too many Division III coaches get the opportunity to ascend to an opportunity to coach at the Division I level. It's a small major market. It's sort of, I would say it's, you know, in the same sort of neighborhood that the Missouri Valley is in with ISU and stuff. So I would say the level of play is going to be higher, but it's something, I mean, I think at the Division III, the highest levels of Division III in women's soccer, the really good players can play at the Division I level, and we've had a lot of those in my career at Illinois Wesleyan. So there'll be different challenges for sure, but I think the level of play will be something I'm really comfortable with and recruiting to. You know, like I said, it was part of the dots that got connected in making this whole thing happen.
Okay, so in the Fairfield world, Division I women's soccer is sort of viewed as a mid-major. Would that be accurate, comparing it to the basketball world?
Yeah, because we're going to be playing in the Metro Athletic Conference with teams like Monmouth in New Jersey, St. Peter's, Iona, Siena. So teams like that who, you know, basketball teams get into the tournament, they're the ones who are like the 15 seed and every now and then knock off a 2 or 3 or something like that. So
how does Fairfield fit within that framework? Is there some work to do out there? Is it a successful program?
It's been successful historically, but we've not made it into the national tournament in 10 years. The last time they won a conference championship was 6 years ago. So finished 6th in the league last year. I think we've got some work to do to get back to where we need to go. It's an exciting challenge, though, because I think there's nowhere to go but up, really, to be honest. And I'm certainly, I think, very optimistic. And after meeting with the team the last couple of days, they're excited about, you know, the possibilities of having, you know, really hitting the reset button and getting a chance to make strides going forward.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton speaking with Illinois Wesleyan women's soccer coach Dave Barrett, who just took a job at Division I Fairfield in Connecticut. Well, let's talk about what you did at Illinois Wesleyan. 17 years ago, you took over a program that was having some success. What was the attraction of the Wesleyan job in the first place when you took it?
Well, I was at a juncture in my life when I was looking for a head coaching position. I was just at a time in my life when it was time to sort of ascend to that level. Illinois Wesleyan was attractive because I was a Division III athlete and student and really appreciated the commitment that is required at that level. And I saw, again, a lot of similarities in what I see now in the Fairfield program. There's a limitless potential, and we took the Illinois Wesleyan program to heights that they were not at in 2001, becoming much more of a national player, you know, getting into a tournament and being, you know, a team that's, you know, regularly in the top 20 in the country. So that took some time and certainly wasn't an overnight success. It took a period of time to kind of get to the point where we were in that conversation, and we're very proud of what we did there, and I think it's in great shape for whomever takes over.
When you took the job and you saw the possibilities, did you know what you wanted to do right away, or did it take a couple of years to figure out exactly how you wanted to bring it up a notch or two?
No, we knew what we wanted to do. I knew what our goals were going to be is to compete at the national level and to compete for conference championships and to be in the conversation at the national level. So no, I mean, I think this is... my goals were pretty clear at the time, 17 years ago, what we wanted to do, we felt like we had a good plan to get there.
Well, let me ask it this way, Coach. What were some of those things that needed to be done to reach the levels Wesleyan is at right now?
I think it was just create a culture of success and expectations at a high standard and attract athletes that were going to be able to produce at that level. More beyond just the borders of Illinois. We needed to grow to become a national program and get players from across the country, which we did. And just grow it to be a competitive program. And I think when I took it over, it was, as you mentioned, there had been some success and wins, but relatively speaking, it wasn't a national, in the national conversation. It wasn't at the point where they were going to contend regularly for any of the things we were talking about. And that took recruiting to get really good players in who were interested in having a really balanced experience and so forth. So get good players and create a good culture, and the rest of it sort of take care of itself.
As a guy who's never played competitive soccer, but I have played some basketball, some baseball, what's the correlation here? You were a goalkeeper when you played soccer. How does that prepare you for coaching? Is it similar to maybe the catcher in baseball, or what's the correlation?
Very similar. No, very similar. You really are forced to kind of understand everything that's going on in front of you. Somewhat of a field general, being able to lead and direct and have a clear understanding of the whole instead of just like your little world. So that's why, I mean, I think you end up seeing in baseball a lot of catchers become managers and so forth, and I would like to think that goalkeepers become good coaches as well, but I would say it's a really good analogy that you just made.
Illinois Wesleyan women's soccer coach Dave Barrett moving on to Fairfield. One question before I let you go.
Yeah.
What's the one thing, can you nail it down to one thing you're most proud of your 17-year tenure at Illinois Wesleyan?
I'm really proud of the quality of people that we produced. I'm obviously proud of the results, proud of the banner that we have hanging in the Shirk Center, proud of all the accomplishments and the national recognition that we've received. But I'm proud of the female athletes that we've coached and have come through and have gone on to be great professionals and moms and wives. I've been lucky enough to be around some great people and stayed in touch with them after they've graduated. So I'm really proud of how, you know, they've grown into really great adults and professionals and, like I said, wives and moms. And it's been a real joy to do that for them.
Outgoing Illinois Wesleyan women's soccer coach Dave Barrett speaking with GLT's John Norton. Barrett last week accepted the head women's soccer coaching position at Fairfield University in Connecticut. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interview and all the individual stories and interviews on our website, WGLT.org. We crave your feedback. We really want to know what you think of this show and what you hear on it. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.